Most people do their nature walks during the day, thereby missing out on the wonders of nature at night. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Sawa Khan. We may associate the night with danger. After all, it's dark, and who knows what's lurking in the garden or the woods. In fact, there's a whole world of amazing sights and sounds we could experience if we did venture out after dark. My guest, Charles Hood, is a naturalist, poet, and author of a book titled Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. He's enthusiastic about that hidden world and has traveled the world to experience and write about what he found.
If you say, you know, picture nature, and we sort of have a sunlit scene, blue sky, some birds, maybe a butterfly goes by or something, maybe a green meadow or something like that. And that's fine. Of course, that exists, and that's something to treasure and to enjoy. However, however, what about the other half? Like, not like nature has an on-off switch, and, you know, when the sun goes down, nature stops being nature. That goes back to the idea that being out at night is A, if you live in a desert, as I do, a more pleasant time to be around. But B, I was hanging around with these animal spotters and snake catchers. I wrote a book about herpetology, about snakes and lizards of the American West. And so being around with these other wildlife experts, they really opened up to me the possibilities of night, and not only to experience it myself, but I'm working with a couple of different people and are really trying to photograph the night without having that deer in the headlights. So not only did I want to encounter the night myself firsthand, but in portraying it for others, to try to find a photographic vocabulary or syntax that's a little less harsh, a little less glaring, easier on the animals, and makes things look less frightened and less frightful, if I can make that distinction.
And I would think you had a lot of adventures while researching the book. Tell us some of what it took to research the book, like your travels, what you might have encountered.
I'll tell a story for your listeners. West Africa, country of Gabon, former French colony, and they have an animal called a giant pangolin. Lots of us know the pangolin as some people call it the scaly anteater. You know, half a dozen species, roughly speaking. But there's one that no one ever sees, the giant one. It's bigger than a Newfoundland dog, weighs 80 pounds from the Congo ecosystem, from West Africa. And through some of my friends, through my contacts in the mammal watching community, we got the idea, there's a possibility to see one if we go into the forest at night at this remote area in Gabon. So some of us went to Gabon and we got the four-wheel drives, and we stayed in the abandoned village, no electricity, no water, just everything sort of like camping in the forest kind of idea, and going out at night. Only because there was no electricity in the abandoned field station we were staying in, we had to be very parsimonious with our lighting. Most of us use rechargeable batteries in our headlamps and our spotlights, but if there's no electricity, the rechargeable part isn't happening. So we're trying to, you know, use very dim setting and sort of one light for every three people on the trail. So I was one of the people without a light. We're in the forest. It's West Africa. It's nighttime. And in French, the guides started shouting, run, run, run. And I thought, well, that's it. We're just dead. Because the problem in the forest are these elephants that are the forest elephants. Most of us know the African elephant as the savanna species. There's actually two species. So the one out in the grasslands in Kenya that you see on safari. And they're relatively predictable. And, you know, they're pretty much not going to trample the car unless you really get in their way, kind of thing. But for whatever reason, the other species that's in the rainforest, the forest elephant, it's actually called, they like to smush people flat. I don't know why. They see a person and they smush it flat. So the guides are yelling, run, run, run. I think that's it. The elephants have found us. We're going to die. I don't even have a flashlight. You know, mine's put away because we're conserving our batteries. It turns out, no, we weren't getting killed by an elephant. I was very, very relieved to find that out. No, the guides had actually found one of these giant pangolins, this immense, it's like prehistoric, you know, this immense beast. And it was out foraging, doing its thing. It eats termites and tears open termite mounds with these giant forearms and huge hooked claws. Kind of looks like a ground sloth, if you know your Pleistocene mammals. And I will say that for the photograph, someone was trying to get the animal just to slow down a little bit. So two of the trackers grabbed its tail, and I probably shouldn't say this on the air, but they did. And two very beefy guy, very, very fit gentlemen could not slow the, it just whipped its little tail around. There's no more, it just trundled off. We were not going to disturb it. So it's a force of its own in the rainforest. So yes, for those of you who want to have adventures, you can go out and have adventures, but it's fine just to go to the city park and look at some glow-in-the-dark lichen, listen to the owls, and have a nice, safe evening.
When you're out, traveling these countries, I assume you have a photographer, or are you taking the pictures?
No, I do my own photography. Or in the book, Nature at Night, there are some great photographs that I didn't take because I know some really wonderful people and they're very gracious with their time and their copyrights, so to speak. So some of the photographs are by my friends.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Charles Hood, naturalist, adventurer, poet, and author of Nature at Night. You write about nocturnal plants, fungi, animals, insects, and the night sky. So let's start with botany. Let's talk about some of the plants that are active at night.
So for all of us that kind of imagine ourselves as nice, happy yellow flowers or red flowers, that means we're probably going to be attracting daytime pollinators, whether they're hummingbirds or butterflies, whatever, or beetles, whatever it's going to be. However, the problem with being a happy red butterfly-loving flower during the daytime is that there are so many other red flowers out there as well. And so a smaller group of flowers have thought, well, of plants, I should say, a smaller group of plants is saying, you know what? What if we blossomed at night? What if we, tried to attract moths? So you look at things that are, bright white with like datura plants or the saguaro cactus in the desert southwest. And for the saguaro cactus, it does have a showy white flower, and it is only pollinated by bats, by nectar-eating bats. And just the same way a hummingbird's attracted to the nectar, this flower produces enough nectar for the bats to come in. And there's a number of advantages for the plant. And number one, of course, bats can fly a long distance, so you're really able to get some great, cross-pollination going on here. Bats can fly hundreds of miles over the course of the season. But also, the thing about being out at night, if you're a saguaro cactus, it's not so hot. And in fact, your nectar goes a lot farther, if you know what I mean. Like, if you could imagine how fast can a cup of coffee evaporate on the side, on the sidewalk in the middle of the day in Tucson, it's going to be gone in an hour. But at night, it might last all night. So there's some advantages there. But they're white, they're not red, because that shows up best. So something like a datura plant, for example, if you see a plant with a white flower, it doesn't necessarily only get pollinated at night, but it's an indicator that that's kind of one of its strategies.
I was fascinated to read about fungi that glow in the dark. Tell us about that, and why do they glow?
A, we don't know. B, they do it. C, they might be trying to attract. Again, we're talking about dispersal of your genetic material. You are a fungi. You wish to have more fungi in your lineage to survive into the future. And so they're using spores in that case. And it may help attract insects like beetles that are going to then forage around and get those spores on them and take them somewhere else. That's a guess. But yes, it is true. Not all of the fungi do, but some fungi are self-generating light. They wouldn't need a you wouldn't need a flashlight. They're glowing on their own. And then other things like lichen luminesce under a UV flashlight, so that if you're looking for scorpions, for example, to pick an organism that fluoresces, all the species fluoresce worldwide. All the scorpions glow in the dark with a UV flashlight. You're hiking at night. You've got the stars above, you've got the coyotes howling, you've got the owls hooting, and the lichens are glowing. You're watching for your scorpions. It's it and you're smelling the you're smelling things because it's nighttime, so the humidity's up a little bit. Your senses are turned on. Can't really look at things at night nearly as much. So you're smelling, you're hearing. It's just a sensory treat. Go out and look at those glow-in-the-dark lichens. Why not? What else? Better than staring at your phone. I can tell you all of that right now. Put your phone away and go look at the lichen.
There are many stories and pictures in the book about birds, including owls. Tell us about owls.
Sure. We all are familiar in North America and all the way down to Central America with the great horned owl. And now that's a lovely animal, Bubu virginianus, a big, obvious owl. And for those of you who are kind of novice owl spotters, the greatest, easiest, fastest way to find out about an owl is to go to a city park with big trees, look at the base of the trees, and you might notice some gray wads of fur. They're called owl pellets. And these are about the size of an adult thumb, a nice, generous, big thumb. Although there's a little bit of variability there. And the owls cannot digest fur and bones just the way their tummies and bottom ends work. And so rather than trying to poop out that kind of hard, sharp material, they wrap the bones in fur, as happens automatically inside the owl, and they cough it up just like a cat coughing up a hairball, and it lands on the ground. And if you're in the desert, it's desiccated and it stays there for years. If you're in a well-watered, green, humid park, it's going to last a couple of days or a week or two before it starts to dissolve if there's a lot of water going on. But if you find an owl pellet, there's two things you can do. Number one, pick it apart and look at the little tiny mouse bones, find out what it's been eating. Little tiny mouse teeth, itty bitty little things, very fun, or rats or raccoons. So you get to pick it apart. I just use my naked hands, to be honest, because I'm kind of vulgar that way. If you want to be a little bit more fastidious, you could put your rubber gloves on, or put it on a little leaf and use a stick to kind of pry it apart. But there, wash your hands afterwards. But it's not messy like dog poo or something. It's perfectly, perfectly acceptable. There's no bad odor. It's just fur and bone. So that tells us what they've been eating, which is, that tells us what else is around at night. And then at the same time, typically they cough those up from their daytime roosts. So if you look straight up in the tree, peer around the trunk, I bet there's an owl looking back down at you. So there's our tip on finding owls. There's lots of other things around, all the night jars. These are sort of, if an owl is a more vertical kind of posture, if you kind of perceive this thing with the big eyes sitting straight up. Night jars are a little, they can sit straight up, but we think of them more typically as a more horizontal kind of bird. And they're mottled colored and they eat moths typically just to pick one prey item. And that's the whippoorwills from the East Coast or the poor wills here in the American deserts. And they are worldwide. There's some that have these real fancy tail streamers and give these haunting kind of calls. So as your sonic environment expands out at night and you begin to listen to all the different options that nature is providing for you, you might hear a distant nightjar. And that, even if you can't find it, they have good eye shine. If you shine your flashlight and you pick one up, it'll reflect back. But if you can't find, if you don't know how to find the nightjar, you can certainly hear it a long distance away.
One of the birds I read about, and I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but it was like a Putu or something like that.
Most people say potu, and they are very, very cryptic. They look exactly like a dead stump. I mean, just oh, I mean, you could be staring straight at one, and if it doesn't open its mouth or blink its eyes, like, oh my gosh, they look like dead, lichen-colored dead wood, and they are big-eyed, vertical sitting, fence post sitting, neotropical. That they're in the New World tropics, moth hunters, and they and other nocturnal insects as well, but they sit motionless, and I like them because if you've got a flashlight with some range on it, a little bit of as they say, throw on your flashlight, and you're in like a forest edge in Panama or Costa Rica or Belize, and there's sort of a pasture, a clearing or a river, an opening, you can pick out those potus a long way away. Their eyes are big and round, and they really reflect the light. Or during the day, if you've got a great naturalist guide, she or he can perhaps point you out to a roosting one that's just sitting there waiting for nightfall. And honest to gosh, oh, you're staring right at it, and they're going right there. Hey, stupid gringo, right there. I did not see it. And then finally, it'll sort of resolve itself. You go, oh my gosh, that has to be the world's most best camouflage job on these potus.
Primates are a pretty diverse group, and I hadn't thought that primates would be nocturnal, but some are. Tell us about that.
As humans, we are vertical bipedal primates, and like the other great apes, we sort of like to go to roost at nighttime. Orangutans and gorillas and chimpanzees, they do make nests every night. Sometimes they reuse them after they make a new nest, and they kind of settle down for the evening. But there are those primates that have, flipped the switch. Again, like the flowers, if you're asking yourself, well, how can I get access to food that no one else wants, or no one else is noticing, or no one else is trying to acquire at the same time, then being a nocturnal primate, assuming you've got some good vision, if you enhance your basic primate vision to be a little bit even more super duper, and so you can see at night pretty well, it actually makes a lot of sense to be out at night, because throughout the world there are things that want to eat primates. In the Philippines there is something actually called a monkey eating eagle. That's the name of it. And of course in the New World jungles we have the harpy eagle, and they can eat something as big as a sloth. So picking off a medium-sized monkey is no problem for a harpy eagle. So if you want to get away from the eagles, come out at night and eat stick insects or cockroaches or figs, fruiting fig plants, whatever. So yeah, there are night monkeys. And then in the old world, there are these smaller species of Galagos. Sometimes they're called bush babies, and they're very fast. Some of them eat tree sap. They've got a variety of foraging strategies. So some of the great apes, orangutans, they do sleep at night and they are active during the day. But other primates have decided, hey, I've got something that no one else can do. I'm going to see at night. I'm going to sleep in a hole in the crevice here in the tree bole, in the center of the tree during the day, and then come out only at night. And that's a reason to be a naturalist at night, just so you can see the night monkeys.
You mentioned big cats, and I don't know if that's because of how their eyes work. Is that why they're out at night?
Well, jaguars can hunt during the day, and they do hunt during the day. And jaguars also, they're very broad spectrum predators. So to pick that cat out of all, and a jaguar has got a bite strength greater than a tiger's. So they, per square inch, and pounds per square inch of bite strength. So they can actually eat a sea turtle, not by like scooping out the innards through the shell, but actually they can crack the shell with their teeth. But one reason that jaguars are going to be hunting at night, probably I'd say 70% of the time, 30% during the day, is simply because A, they have the benefit of darkness, so the animals can't see them coming. And then B, things that they want to eat, these things called pacas. A paca is a little forest foraging animal, like an agouti, if you know that animal from the zoo. But they want to catch, their prey. They would love to eat pacas and agoutis all day. So the jaguars are out at night. And can they see well? Oh, sure. You betcha. So if we imagine if it's daytime now when you're listening to this program, and you look out with your lovely human binocular vision and you say, oh, I can see a tree and I can see a car and I can see a light and I can see the mailman, I can see the dog across the street. As easily as we see during the day, an owl can see that well at night. It's hard to imagine for us because we do have good night vision, as I mentioned, but we don't have that good a night vision that we can actually like pick out a black poodle on a black night from across the street kind of thing. So jaguars, when they're hunting at night, they have got access to the world through their senses, through their, obviously they've got keen hearing, keen smell, but also they can see so much better than we can.
And then there are the bats, which are also out at night.
I can't tell your audience how much I love bats. And the problem is there are so many misperceptions, that they want to get in your hair and they're vampires and blah, 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 blah. And the problem with night in general is we tend to demonize darkness overall and demonize, and otherize things that we don't have direct experience with or a direct folkloric, narrative that helps make it seem, benign. I was thinking the other day about werewolves. Like we all know real wolves can be white in the Arctic, or most of the wolves are gray most of the time. There are a few black wolves, but we're talking, what is 5% or 10% of the population of real wolves are actually black. But werewolves are always, every werewolf in every movie has always been black. We always make the evil things be, the cowboys that are the bad cowboys have the dark hats. So we really, we demonize the darkness so very, very, so very, very much. And that applies then to bats as well. So they're witches familiar. So they give you rabies. If you do see a bat flopping around on the ground, foaming at the mouth during the daytime, take this tip and run with it. Do not pick it up. If it's a strange dog acting, menacingly, don't pet the dog. Let's use some common sense, y'all. But no, bats are no more rabid than anything else. And it is true, you could get rabies from a bat, but it's not likely to happen. And instead, bats are just doing all these great, cool, fun things like eating the moths that lay the caterpillars, they get on our crops, so they're doing a farmer's a great service. And they do eat more than just insects. They help revegetate the rainforest by eating fruit. Some of the fruit-eating bats excrete out the seeds as they fly, and so a cleared area can become revegetated, reforested, thanks to the efforts of the bats. There is a kind of bat in South America, two species actually, that eat fish. And that is their diet. I guess they could catch an insect once in a great, 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 great while, but they eat fish. And they listen with their super keen bat hearing to the minnow's fin breaking the surface of the water. Isn't that great to think about? The fish is going along, making a little tiny little fishy wake, and the fishing bat comes down with sharp talons and scoops it up. It's got a sort of webbed membrane between its tail and its back legs, scoops it up, flies up into the rainforest canopy, hangs upside down, and slurps the bat, head down, eats the fish by slurping it up into its mouth. So fish-eating bats in the Amazon. There's also a third species that catch saltwater minnows in Baja California. There is such a thing as a vampire bat that does exist. A little, it's pretty small. If it was alive and in a calm mood, you could hold it in your hand like a baby sparrow. They're pretty small. They fit in your cup of your hand. Odds of it being kind of calm and relaxed are pretty small. They're feisty little guys. Thing about vampire bats is they actually approach their prey on the ground. So if you're a big drowsy cow with a big warm butt radiating heat out there into the tropical night, the vampire bat will sense that, drop down on the ground, and then scurry up and then crawl on to the haunch of the big, fat, sleepy, drowsy cow, and with razor sharp scalpel like teeth, make two tiny little incisions, just itty bitty little nicks, and then lap up the blood. And the saliva of the bat has an anticoagulant, so the blood will keep flowing, and then they crawl off and fly away. Nothing bad happens to the cow. The wounds can get infected, hypothetically. I don't think that happens as much as the farmers claim they do, but it's not like they're going to land on a human and drain all your blood and you're going to wake up deceased in the morning. There's vampire bats that are specialists on sleeping birds. Like, they're just such a diverse, interesting group. I said there's 1,400 species. Like, wow. Wow, that's just so amazing. They're all out there, different colors, different sizes, all the way up to 6 feet across, all the way down to, the size of your, oh, a couple, your pinky finger and the ring finger next to it, the fingertips. So good for bats. Go out and have some appreciation for them.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here with Charles Hood. He's a naturalist, adventurer, poet, and author of Nature at Night. You talk in the book about night skies, which can provide some remarkable sights. Do you have any nighttime sky experiences to share?
I just want to encourage us all just to take advantage of this free show. It's free. It's out there every night. It may be that you're in a city, but you still can see the moon or maybe see Venus or something like that. But often just going an hour's drive, half an hour's drive out of town. We have to kind of fight against technology on this. Society is very good at flooding our evenings with light. There's security lights in front of houses, high beams on cars. And even when you get into your car, the modern cars want to give you light, whether you need it or not. You hop in and take your little drive out to the countryside, get out on a little dirt pull out on the side of the road and just look up. Preferably on a moonless night, a night of the new moon. Every 2 weeks, there's a new moon. Every 2 weeks later, there's a full moon, and it cycles back around. So, at a moonless night, and just look at the sky, and you're looking up at so many millions of millions and millions of miles of potentially music, poetry, other life. We don't know what's up there, but we do know there's a lot of beauty to be had just from the starlight. And for those people in the northern hemisphere who are north of a certain imaginary line, you're going to have a good aurora this coming winter. If you live in northern hemisphere, we're at the solar maximum coming up, and so there's going to be some more aurora borealis action.
Have you seen the aurora?
I first saw it actually from an airplane. I was flying from Los Angeles to Boston one winter, and you can see it out the airplane window. Northern lights are easy and fun, but you can just go to any northern location. Go to Tromsø in Norway, for example. Plan a vacation, but you need to be there a few nights because you can't guarantee when the solar wind is going to be ejected by the sun at the strong enough, powerful enough force to trigger this visual manifestation of the excited electrons that are dancing around 80 miles up in the sky.
You say when there's a crescent moon, that's a good time to study the moon. Why is that?
If you enlarge the full moon to with binoculars or with a friend's bird watching telescope or in a private, you know, a cheap astronomy scope or something, the full moon is reflecting the sun and it's actually very, very, very bright. It's actually hard to see details in it. The crescent moon is reflecting less light, but also then is allowing the light to rake at an angle across the lunar surface. And the moon has got great mountains. You know, they're crater rims for the most part, but with binoculars or with a, you know, borrow someone's, you know, birdwatching telescope, you can actually make out the details with incredible crispness. Again, you've got to be outside of the city is a little bit better for this. You can do it in the city, but it's better to get to a dark environment.
Right. So you're referencing the light pollution that we see pretty much all around us. Why are dark skies preferable?
So we know from folklore that we have a lot of mythology associated with night skies, and that's true for all cultural organizations, whether you're Native American or Scandinavian, African American, African. If you don't see the night sky, you can't apply the lessons and enjoy the details of these narratives that have come down to us for the many thousands of years. And so we're really forfeiting part of our cultural heritage that way. And then I do want to say that it's just fun. It's just nice. It's just beautiful. It's just heartwarming to look up and say, oh my gosh, you see the Milky Way in the Northern Hemisphere. It's better seen in the summer. It's just the way the planet tilts and aims out, the way the planet looks out at space, the Northern Hemisphere. We want to look at the Milky Way during the summer. In the Southern Hemisphere, you want to look at the Southern Cross and the Magellanic clouds and things like that. But looking, if you see the Milky Way from a dark sky site on a moonless night in the middle of summer, and it's temperature and you're with your friends and you've got a little campsite set up, but you've got your lights turned off temporarily, it is so beautiful, so inspiring. It just makes your heart swell because you can't believe the gorgeous pageantry, you know, the great tapestry, all the cliches you want to use that is the night sky. What a great privilege, what a great gift it is to have access to that.
What do you hope your readers come away with after reading your book?
I want to give people permission to just enjoy nature anytime. That's fine. You don't need to see a scorpion with a flashlight, but especially to feel access or privileged, you know, to go out at night. And it can just be a half mile walk on a nature trail or around a park. It doesn't have to be a big expedition to Gabon with the charging elephants. And, you know, it doesn't have to be on a boat to Tromso, Norway in the middle of winter, which was a cold trip as much as it was. It could just be something local and easy and fun.
If you do venture out at night, Hood says to be sure to take a couple of flashlights, maybe some extra batteries, a charged cell phone, and water. Wear clothing that's appropriate for the weather. Instead of exploring a whole new area at night, it's advisable to first walk the route in the daytime, so you can become familiar with the pathway and any possible obstructions. Walking a familiar path also lessens the chance that you'll become lost in the dark. That's all for now. Thanks to our guest, author Charles Hood, who's hoping you'll get out on a dark night, look at the stars while listening to a night bird calling. Until next time, this is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.